Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. Episode 151, Feeling Full? This episode of Craftlit is brought to you by The Loop Knittery at loopknittery.co.nz and holiday travel. If you just can't think of what you want for Christmas this year, maybe it should be a trip to London, Bath, and Wales next year. Not that I was freaked out by them playing Christmas music today at the doctor's office, but they were playing Christmas music today at the doctor's office, and it seems to me that they were playing Christmas music, a couple of weeks ago, before Thanksgiving, like right after October 31st. I heard a rumor that that was actually a real thing this year, that they were trying to drum up some shopping far in advance of actual, what is it that they call it, Black Friday, the big shopping day, the extravaganza when JCPenney's here opened at 4 a.m. to try and get as many shopping hours in. I have yet to participate in that whole melee. I don't really like that kind of shopping all that much. So, you know, one more thing that makes me different. Because clearly, plenty of people do it. So, it's just me. I know, and I'm comfortable with that. I've come to terms with my shortcomings, and I'm going to embrace them and save some money right now. I am knitting or painting all of my Christmas and Hanukkah presents this year because it is a stash-busting kind of holiday season for me. There is just nothing that I'm going to be able to buy for anyone. So, you know, it's better for me to make stuff for people anyway. So there it is. But in this giving season, I am putting out the Kickstart call once again. If you know anyone who you think would like to donate to a worthy cause, which would be paying someone to help me recode everything for Craftlit so we can make the earlier episodes smaller and make everything better, I would really like to be able to pay the people who help me, and that won't be possible without the support at the Kickstarter.com page. So that link will be on the show notes. It is also in the left-hand sidebar of the show notes page. And I've been trying to kind of slowly but surely replace flawed code or things that I just didn't like very much. So I'm fixing the library so that each audio file now has a player button. So all you have to do is click on the triangle and you'll be able to listen to all 151 episodes. Those of you who had gotten the iPhone or iTouch application right off the bat, two things happened. One, either you were told that it wasn't available and then the next day it was. And number two, the other thing that may have happened is that you thought you would have all 150 episodes on your iPod or iTouch suddenly, and you only went back to episode 63. That was because the good people at, I'm not sure which end of things, either the people who helped build the thing or the people who host my feed, decided that no one would really want to have their application slowed down to the level it would take in order to put all of those files out there. I wrote back to them and said, no, that's actually exactly what everybody wants. So, you know, it may take a few more seconds to load, but I think we can be patient. It's just our way. So that has been fixed. Now, the interesting thing was when they shut the feed down so that only the last 100 or so episodes would go into the iPhone app, that also stopped it from going into iTunes. So if you were any of the people who suddenly went, geez, there's only episode 63 and on iTunes, what's going on? that's what happened. Once they fixed it, it was fixed everywhere. So if that's still a problem, please email me at heather@craftlit.com and I will try and figure out what new weirdness has attacked us. But for now, I think it's pretty settled. And again, if you have any problems with the application, do let me know. There's also a problem with the contact form on the craftlit.com website. That's been fixed, so yay. And thank you to you Sterling people who remembered the email address and emailed me when the contact form wasn't working. Finally figured that one out. You know, there's just only so much, which reminds me, between now and the middle of December, right now it is November 30th, 2009. Between now and the middle of December, I will probably not be podcasting again because the next 2 weeks are the end of the semester, which means my life is a grading melee. And the other thing is, and of course it all happens at once, my sister's getting married to a lovely man from Germany. We're all very excited, and I'm practicing my German, but I'm performing the ceremony, and we're still finalizing text, so, you know, lots of little things still need to happen, and I just don't have time, you know? And I kind of figured you would understand me prioritizing my sister above all y'all, and forgive me for that. Thank you also to you who have written to say that what a nice voice my father had. I passed those comments on to him and hope that it will tempt him to come back and record more for us. I know it's something he wants to do. I'm hoping it's something we can convince him to do because I liked his voice too. Although, I have to admit, the woman who is reading for Libsyn, Ruth Golding, is quite an excellent reader, don't you think? I just really like her voice. Turns out she's done quite a number of books and short stories and poems and things for LibriVox. And her website is golding.wordpress.com. I am going to put up a link to her own site because from there, she calls it her Catablog. It's a list of her audiobook recordings. And from there, you can go straight from the category that she lists for what she has read, and then you can hop right on over to LibriVox and get that. And speaking of LibriVox, I just had to share this with you because now I am absolutely intrigued. On the LibriVox homepage, every once in a while, they put up a little, I don't know, notice or essay. It's kind of like what they do for NaNoWriMo for National Novel Writing Month, which, by the way, we were successful again. Barely. Just that razor's edge of barely. But that's okay. Very happy about it. But one of the things that they did here on LibriVox is that they put a note that said, about that Ulysses recording, ... And I thought, you know, that's a really tempting headline. I'm kind of curious about this Ulysses recording. It turns out that there is only one Ulysses recording. It was started right at the beginning of LibriVox in the late fall of 2005, and it wasn't completed until the summer of 2007. And it is evidently very odd, kind of in the spirit of Ulysses. So these were the rules that they gave themselves, this, you know, small posse of people who were reading, one of whom was our Pride and Prejudice reader. She was evidently one of the earliest readers, which was why we were able to get the audio in the first place. So these were their rules. One, editing was allowed but not required. You can record as is, bad sound, background noise, whatever will add to the experience. I think James Joyce would approve. Two, extra points for recording in a pub or public place on the street is good. Number three, bonus points if you record in Dublin. Four, you are encouraged to get others to help you record your chapter. Five, more extra points for getting several people to record with you in a pub. Six, square those points if those other people are strangers. And the target completion date was midnight June 14th, 2006. The actual completion date was June 16th, 2007. Now, some of the comments that they've gotten, and this is just for chapter one, they said, the recorders of chapter one have been called, there's a colon, fools, jerks, jocks, idiots, criminals, and worse. The recording has been called an insult to Joyce, an insult to listeners, an insult to literature, a travesty, a hoax, a bad joke, and embarrassing, among other things. And one listener suggested that his dog would do a better job of making the recording. So it turns out that this Ulysses recording, which I have not listened to, I only found this just minutes ago, is something of kind of a creative free-for-all. Each chapter is recorded differently, and it just sounds hysterical. They said, if you don't like the background noise and the pub noises and all the other weird editing things that they did, they said there is, as of today, a catalog of 2,879 non-Ulysses audiobooks for you to choose from. I can recommend a few if you like. And then they gave a couple of links to other things that were also creatively done. But now, I'm just absolutely fascinated. It's 32 hours of audio. And there was a woman who said, I wanted to read this to you. For the last 3 years, LibriVox has become one of my best friends. I'm nearly 75. One bad thing is my eyesight has been getting dimmer every year. One good thing is that there are great volunteers at LibriVox, making my days a little brighter. I would like to comment on your commentary, Hugh. I have over 400 books in my LibriVox library. It is a daily enjoyment for me to listen to 8 or 10 hours. I have 3 different MP3 players, each with a different story. So I can say I do have some listening experience. I do hope those who read your commentary do not get the impression that liberties are freely taken and books are put out only to mark up another book finished. My sincere thank you to all of your readers. It is obvious you are devoted to your unpaid task, putting your heart and soul into your readings. Your commitment is appreciated. So, I just thought that was very nice and wonderful, and that, you know, she kind of speaks it for all of us. Not to say that I'm not going to write a thank you to them as well for the, you know, many, many years now that we have been together and doing this audio thing. It's all been a great adventure, and we started with LibriVox, so that's not such a bad thing. And speaking of books, I'm going to skip over Crafty Talk today because, honestly, I don't have time, and I want to get you the next chapter, so at least you'll have something to mull over the next couple of weeks as you continue on your merry way through life and I go and marry my sister. Or that sounds funny, doesn't it? Make it so that my sister can be married to the man that she loves. So Flatland today is going to be a little interesting. We've already gotten a really great conversation going, and I have to thank Knitting Rose and her Big Texan for starting us off on the Craftlit Ravelry group. So if you haven't been there before and you're on Ravelry, go join the Craftlit group and then hop on the Flatland discussion, because Big Texan has been saying some mighty important things about the nth dimension, which I decided happily I was going to not get into with you. It actually requires you to look at, you know, like a formula. And he did a much better job of explaining it than I would have done. So he helps make the flat plane world make more sense. And once again, before we head into today's reading, I just ask you to think of your floor as the plane. And if you were to, say, put a deck of cards on that plane and then took a box of BBs and shot them across the floor, just dumped them on the floor so they all rattle and head towards that deck of cards, that would be like the rain coming from the north down onto the roof of the house. And if you had turned your deck of cards at a diagonal, or if you'd aimed at the corner, that would have actually been even more appropriate. Because if you remember, the peak of the polygon is the peak of the roof. If you looked at that, the drawing with the line RO and line OF creating the roof of the little polygonal house. So just try and remember that everything, as far as we're concerned, is going to be moving horizontally. I have a hard time thinking of a plane as being a vertical object, so I really have been thinking of this whole thing as a flat horizontal plane which means that the only thing they can see is basically the side of each other. And I know you're thinking to yourself, well, then how can you tell the difference between a square and a isosceles and all these things? Abbott goes a long way towards explaining that phenomenon over the next couple chapters. First, we start with the women. We've already talked a little bit about the women, and I hope that the satire is becoming quite clear. And if it hasn't, I am hoping that this chapter will really kick it into high gear. Because remember, Abbott was teaching at a university that was very progressive. He was all for the education of women in a time when not everybody was. He thought women's suffrage was just kind of a no-brainer, and that women were, by being kept in their place, it was kind of obvious that that was not such a wise idea for all of the reasons that have already gone through your minds. There is a footnote that you will hear in our first chapter today, or section. It, depending on your version of the book, it's either chapter 4 or section 4. You're going to hear this footnote break into the narrative, and you might be tempted to think that that footnote was added to a newer edition as a way to answer for what seems like outrageously sexist language. And it's not. It was actually in the original text, which means that Abbott knew full well exactly what he was saying. And he knew how it was going to incite some of his readers. And so he tried to kind of do a preemptive strike to keep you reading, honestly, because how can you get to the end of the satire if you don't know that it's satire? You know, then you're just going to get angry and walk away. So in this chapter, you're going to start to notice that A Square, our narrator, is presenting a Flatlander's version of what women are like and what their weaknesses and flaws are. And if you listen closely, you'll hear that by saying these things, he is starting to reveal the fact that women are not the pigeon heads that his his entire dimension seemed to think they are, and that perhaps the things that the women are doing are not, oh, I don't know, a response to being stupid, but are in fact a response to being completely subjugated by the polygons. It really is a lovely, he does a lovely job in this chapter. I really like what he does in the women's chapter. And I urge you to pay close attention to the end of the fourth chapter. And I'm going to give you the first line of it, the beginning of the paragraph, so that you'll know it's coming, just so you have a heads up. So when he says, "To my readers in Spaceland, the condition of our women may seem truly deplorable," and then it goes on from there. And yeah, pay real close attention to that, because it's just his obvious disdain for the treatment of women in Victorian society is palpable. And I think, of course, I would think commendable. But that's just me. So I'm going to play you chapter 4, and then I'll pop back and give you some info on chapter 5.
Flatland, A Romance of Many Dimensions by Edwin Abbott Abbott. Part 1, Section 4, Concerning the Women. If our highly pointed triangles of the soldier class are formidable, it may be readily inferred that far more formidable are our women. For if a soldier is a wedge, a woman is a needle, being, so to speak, all point, at least at the two extremities. Add to this the power of making herself practically invisible at will, and you will perceive that a female in Flatland is a creature by no means to be trifled with. But here, perhaps, some of my younger readers may ask how a woman in Flatland can make herself invisible. This ought, I think, to be apparent without any explanation. However, a few words will make it clear to the most unreflecting. place a needle on a table. Then, with your eye on the level of the table, look at it sideways, and you see the whole length of it. But look at it endways, and you see nothing but a point. It has become practically invisible. Just so is it with one of our women. When her side is turned towards us, we see her as a straight line. When the end containing her eye or mouth, for with us these two organs are identical, is the part that meets our eye, then we see nothing but a highly lustrous point. But when the back is presented to our view, then, being only sublustrous, and indeed almost as dim as an inanimate object, her hinder extremity serves her as a kind of invisible cap. The dangers to which we are exposed from our women must now be manifest to the meanest capacity in Spaceland. If even the angle of a respectable triangle in the middle class is not without its dangers, if to run against a working man involves a gash, if collision with an officer of the military class necessitates a serious wound, if a mere touch from the vertex of a private soldier brings with it danger of death, what can it be to run against a woman except absolute and immediate destruction? And when a woman is invisible, or visible only as a dim, sublustrous point, how difficult must it be, even for the most cautious, always to avoid collision? Many are the enactments made at different times in the different states of Flatland in order to minimise this peril. And in the southern and less temperate climates, where the force of gravitation is greater and human beings more liable to casual and involuntary motions, the laws concerning women are naturally much more stringent. But a general view of the code may be obtained from the following summary. 1. Every house shall have one entrance in the eastern side for the use of females only, by which all females shall enter in a becoming and respectful manner, and not by the men's or western door. Footnote. When I was in Spaceland, I understood that some of your priestly circles have in the same way a separate entrance for villagers, farmers, and teachers of board schools. Spectator, September 1884, page 1255. That they may approach in a becoming and respectful manner. End of footnote. 2. No female shall walk in any public place without continually keeping up her peace cry under penalty of death. 3. Any female duly certified to be suffering from St. Vitus's dance, fits, chronic cold accompanied by violent sneezing, or any disease necessitating involuntary motions, shall be instantly destroyed. In some of the states there is an additional law forbidding females under penalty of death from walking or standing in any public place without moving their backs constantly from right to left, so as to indicate their presence to those behind them. Others oblige a woman, when travelling, to be followed by one of her sons or servants, or by her husband. Others confine women altogether to their houses, except during the religious festivals. But it has been found by the wisest of our circles or statesmen that the multiplication of restrictions on females tends not only to the debilitation and diminution of the race, but also to the increase of domestic murders, to such an extent that a state loses more than it gains by a too prohibitive code. For whenever the temper of the women is thus exasperated by confinement at home or hampering regulations abroad, they are apt to vent their spleen upon their husbands and children. And in the less temperate climates, the whole male population of a village has been sometimes destroyed in one or two hours of simultaneous female outbreak. Hence, the three laws mentioned above suffice for the better regulated states, and may be accepted as a rough exemplification of our female code. After all, our principal safeguard is found not in legislature, but in the interests of the women themselves. For although they can inflict instantaneous death by a retrograde movement, yet unless they can at once disengage their stinging extremity from the struggling body of their victim, their own frail bodies are liable to be shattered. The power of fashion is also on our side. I pointed out that in some less civilized states, no female is suffered to stand in any public place without swaying her back from right to left. This practice has been universal among ladies of any pretensions to breeding in all well-governed states, as far back as the memory of figures can reach. It is considered a disgrace to any state that legislation should have to enforce what ought to be, and is in every respectable female, a natural instinct. The rhythmical and, if I may say so, well-modulated undulation of the back in our ladies of circular rank is envied and imitated by the wife of a common equilateral, who can achieve nothing beyond a mere monotonous swing, like the ticking of a pendulum. And the regular tick of the equilateral is no less admired and copied by the wife of the progressive and aspiring isosceles, in the females of whose family no back motion of any kind has become as yet a necessity of life. Hence, in every family of position and consideration, back motion is as prevalent as time itself, and the husbands and sons in these households enjoy immunity, at least from invisible attacks. Not that it must be for a moment supposed that our women are destitute of affection. But unfortunately, the passion of the moment predominates in the frail sex over every other consideration. This is, of course, a necessity arising from their unfortunate conformation. For as they have no pretensions to an angle, being inferior in this respect to the very lowest of the isosceles, they are consequently wholly devoid of brain power, and have neither reflection, judgment, nor forethought, and hardly any memory. Hence, in their fits of fury, they remember no claims and recognize no distinctions. I have actually known a case where a woman has exterminated her whole household, and half an hour afterwards, when her rage was over and the fragments swept away, has asked what has become of her husband and her children. Obviously, then, a woman is not to be irritated as long as she is in a position where she can turn round. When you have them in their apartments, which are constructed with a view to denying them that power, you can say and do what you like, for they are then wholly impotent for mischief, and will not remember a few minutes hence the incident for which they may be at this moment threatening you with death, nor the promises which you may have found it necessary to make in order to pacify their fury. On the whole, we get on pretty smoothly in our domestic relations, except in the lower strata of the military classes. There, the want of tact and discretion on the part of the husbands produces at times indescribable disasters. Relying too much on the offensive weapons of their acute angles instead of the defensive organs of good sense and seasonable simulations, these reckless creatures too often neglect the prescribed construction of the women's apartments, or irritate their wives by ill-advised expressions out of doors, which they refuse immediately to retract. Moreover, a blunt and stolid regard for literal truth indisposes them to make those lavish promises by which the more judicious circle can in a moment pacify his consort. The result is massacre. Not, however, without its advantages, as it eliminates the more brutal and troublesome of the isosceles, and by many of our circles the destructiveness of the thinner sex is regarded as one among many providential arrangements for suppressing redundant population and nipping revolution in the bud. Yet even in our best regulated and most approximately circular families, I cannot say that the ideal of family life is so high as with you in Spaceland. There is peace, in so far as the absence of slaughter may be called by that name, but there is necessarily little harmony of tastes or pursuits. And the cautious wisdom of the circles has ensured safety at the cost of domestic comfort. In every circular or polygonal household, it has been a habit from time immemorial, and has now become a kind of instinct among the women of our higher classes, that the mothers and daughters should constantly keep their eyes and mouths towards their husband and his male friends. And for a lady in a family of distinction to turn her back upon her husband would be regarded as a kind of portent involving loss of status. But, as I shall soon show, this custom, though it has the advantage of safety, is not without its disadvantages. In the house of the working man or respectable tradesman, where the wife is allowed to turn her back upon her husband while pursuing her household avocations, there are at least intervals of quiet when the wife is neither seen nor heard, except for the humming sound of the continuous peace cry. But in the homes of the upper classes there is too often no peace. There the voluble mouth and bright penetrating eye are ever directed towards the master of the household, and light itself is not more persistent than the stream of feminine discourse. The tact and skill which suffice to avert a woman's sting are unequal to the task of stopping a woman's mouth. And as the wife has absolutely nothing to say, and absolutely no constraint of wit, sense, or conscience to prevent her from saying it, not a few cynics have been found to aver that they prefer the danger of the death-dealing but inaudible sting to the safe sonorousness of a woman's other end. To my readers in Spaceland, the condition of our women may seem truly deplorable. And so indeed it is. A male of the lowest type of the isosceles may look forward to some improvement of his angle, and to the ultimate elevation of the whole of his degraded caste. But no woman can entertain such hopes for her sex. Once a woman, always a woman, is a decree of nature, and the very laws of evolution seem suspended in her disfavour. Yet at least we can admire the wise prearrangement which has ordained that, as they have no hopes, so they shall have no memory to recall, and no forethought to anticipate the miseries and humiliations which are at once a necessity of their existence and the basis of the constitution of Flatland.
Nice, huh? Yes, so women have a few challenges in Flatland. I'm sure you all appreciated how they have to wiggle their hindside just to just to keep the men from getting nervous, because they could inflict instant death on anyone. The humming sound of the continuous peace cry. Yes, I thought that was really quite lovely. And I also thought, interestingly, that someone of the day, or even now, could probably pretty easily just read right through that and think it was just a description of how things worked in Flatland. And gee, didn't that really stink for the women, and kind of walk on by. But Abbott really, I think he does a brilliant job with that chapter. In our next chapter, chapter 5, which is of our methods of recognizing one another, this starts to go towards dealing with one of the comments that popped up on the Ravelry group as well. How can they tell what each other is if they can't see down from above? You know, how can they tell who has what angle if all they're doing is seeing a straight line, or the pinpoint head of the woman, or the very dim hind end of the woman? You know, how How can you tell who you're talking to? Well, he starts to deal with that in this chapter. And if I can, I'm going to add chapter 6 because that is the continuation of this whole how do you represent things. One of the comments that's made in the annotations to this chapter is that A Square makes some comment about how it's very difficult to demonstrate to us, people who live in space, how they can tell what another shape's angles are, since they can't see them. And the comment that's made by the gentleman who did the annotations, which would be Ian Stewart, who I really, really think is brilliant, his comment is that we actually experience the same thing, much as it would be very hard for someone in a two-dimensional world to recognize the angles of a two-dimensional object. We are actually using two-dimensional-ish, or at least flat for the most part, senses in order to see a three-dimensional world. And the point is, in order for us to see three dimensions, we have to have both eyes working in concert with each other. And for all intents and purposes, the retinas are flat. Which is why, if you, even with your two eyes, if you look at a single word on a page, your field of vision, you know, if you're holding it at regular reading distance, your field of vision will see that word clearly, but really everything else is kind of blurry. That is a demonstration, according to Mr. Stewart, of how our binocular vision has its own limitations. And so when you hear A Square talking about how they manage, even though there are limitations, he asks that we give A Square the benefit of the doubt on this one, because we actually experience something very similar in our own world. And of course, you all have done the experiment where you, you know, close one eye and look at something and it looks pretty flat. You know, it's hard, very hard to sense depth. And then you open the other eye and you have a completely different picture of the same thing, but from, you know, a slightly different angle. And it's also flat, but then when you have both eyes working, you have a much better shot at tracking distance and depth and things like that. Unless, of course, you are trying to parallel park a car with a new boyfriend in that vehicle, in which case all depth perception is off and you just need to call it a day. So here we are. We are going to do Chapter 5 of Flatland.
Section 5 of Our Methods of Recognizing One Another. You, who are blessed with shade as well as light, you who are gifted with two eyes, endowed with a knowledge of perspective, and charmed with the enjoyment of various colours, you who can actually see an angle and contemplate the complete circumference of a circle in the happy region of the three dimensions, how shall I make clear to you the extreme difficulty which we in Flatland experience in recognizing one another's configurations? Recall what I told you above. All beings in Flatland, animate or inanimate, no matter what their form, present to our view the same or nearly the same appearance, viz. That of a straight line. How, then, can one be distinguished from another where all appear the same? The answer is threefold. The first means of recognition is the sense of hearing, which with us is far more highly developed than with you, and which enables us not only to distinguish by the voice our personal friends, but even to discriminate between different classes, at least so far as concerns the three lowest orders, the equilateral, the square, and the pentagon, for of the isosceles I take no account. But as we ascend in the social scale, the process of discriminating and being discriminated by hearing increases in difficulty. Partly because voices are assimilated, partly because the faculty of voice discrimination is a plebeian virtue not much developed among the aristocracy. and wherever there is any danger of imposture, we cannot trust to this method. Amongst our lowest orders, the vocal organs are developed to a degree more than correspondent with those of hearing, so that an isosceles can easily feign the voice of a polygon, and with some training, that of a circle himself. A second method is therefore more commonly resorted to. Feeling is, among our women and lower classes, about our upper classes I shall speak presently, the principal test of recognition, at all events between strangers, and when the question is not as to the individual but as to the class. What, therefore, introduction is among the higher classes in Spaceland, that the process of feeling is with us. Permit me to ask you to feel and be felt by my friend Mr. So-and-so, is still among the more old-fashioned of our country gentlemen in districts remote from towns, the customary formula for a flatland introduction. But in the towns, and among men of business, the words be felt by are omitted, and the sentence is abbreviated to, let me ask you to feel Mr. So-and-so, although it is assumed, of course, that the feeling is to be reciprocal. Among our still more modern and dashing young gentlemen, who are extremely averse to superfluous effort and supremely indifferent to the purity of their native language, the formula is still further curtailed by the use of to feel in a technical sense, meaning to recommend for the purposes of feeling and being felt. And at this moment the slang of polite or fast society in the upper classes sanctions such a barbarism as, Mr. Smith, permit me to feel you, Mr. Jones. Let not my reader, however, suppose that feeling is with us the tedious process that it would be with you, or that we find it necessary to feel right round all the sides of every individual before we determine the class to which he belongs. Long practice and training, begun in the schools and continued in the experience of daily life, enable us to discriminate at once by the sense of touch between the angles of an equal-sided triangle, square, and pentagon. And I need not say that the brainless vertex of an acute-angled isosceles is obvious to the dullest touch. It is therefore not necessary, as a rule, to do more than feel a single angle of any individual. And this, once ascertained, tells us the class of the person whom we are addressing, unless, indeed, he belongs to the higher sections of the nobility. There the difficulty is much greater. Even a Master of Arts in our University of Wentbridge has been known to confuse a 10-sided with a 12-sided polygon, and there is hardly a Doctor of Science in or out of that famous university who could pretend to decide promptly and unhesitatingly between a 20-sided and a 24-sided member of the aristocracy. Those of my readers who recall the extracts I gave above from the legislative code concerning women will readily perceive that the process of introduction by contact requires some care and discretion. Otherwise the angles might inflict on the unwary feeler irreparable injury. It is essential for the safety of the feeler that the felt should stand perfectly still. A start, a fidgety shifting of the position, yes, even a violent sneeze, has been known before now to prove fatal to the incautious, and to nip in the bud many a promising friendship. Especially is this true among the lower classes of the triangles. With them, the eye is situated so far from their vertex that they can scarcely take cognizance of what goes on at that extremity of their frame. They are, moreover, of a rough, coarse nature, not sensitive to the delicate touch of the highly organized polygon. What wonder, then, if an involuntary toss of the head has ere now deprived the state of a valuable life? I have heard that my excellent grandfather, one of the least irregular of his unhappy isosceles class, who indeed obtained, shortly before his decease, 4 out of 7 votes from the Sanitary and Social Board for passing him into the class of the equal-sided, often deplored with a tear in his venerable eye a miscarriage of this kind, which had occurred to his great-great-great-grandfather, a respectable working man with an angle or brain of 59 degrees 30 minutes. According to his account, my unfortunate ancestor, being afflicted with rheumatism and in the act of being felt by a polygon, by one sudden start, accidentally transfixed the great man through the diagonal, and thereby, partly in consequence of his long imprisonment and degradation, and partly because of the moral shock which pervaded the whole of my ancestor's relations, threw back our family a degree and a half in their ascent towards better things. The result was that in the next generation the family brain was registered at only 58 degrees, and not till the lapse of 5 generations was the lost ground recovered, the full 60 degrees attained, and the ascent from the isosceles finally achieved. And all this series of calamities from one little accident in the process of feeling. At this point, I think I hear some of my better-educated readers exclaim, "How could you in Flatland know anything about angles and degrees or minutes? We can see an angle, because we in the region of space can see 2 straight lines inclined to one another. But you, who can see nothing but 1 straight line at a time, or at all events only a number of bits of straight lines all in 1 straight line, how can you ever discern any angle, and much less register angles of different sizes?" I answer that though we cannot see angles, we can infer them, and this with great precision. Our sense of touch, stimulated by necessity and developed by long training, enables us to distinguish angles far more accurately than your sense of sight, when unaided by a rule or measure of angles. Nor must I omit to explain that we have great natural helps. It is with us a law of nature that the brain of the isosceles class shall begin at 0.5 degree, or 30 minutes, and shall increase, if it increases at all, by 0.5 degree in every generation, until the goal of 60 degrees is reached, when the condition of serfdom is quitted and the freeman enters the class of regulars. Consequently, nature herself supplies us with an ascending scale or alphabet of angles for 0.5 degree up to 60 degrees, specimens of which are placed in every elementary school throughout the land. Owing to occasional retrogressions, to still more frequent moral and intellectual stagnation, and to the extraordinary fecundity of the criminal and vagabond classes, there is always a vast superfluity of individuals of the 0.5 degree and single degree class, and a fair abundance of specimens up to 10 degrees. These are absolutely destitute of civic rights, and a great number of them, not having even intelligence enough for the purposes of warfare, are devoted by the state to the service of education. Fettered immovably, so as to remove all possibility of danger, they are placed in the classrooms of our infant schools, and there they are utilised by the Board of Education for the purpose of imparting to the offspring of the middle classes that tact and intelligence of which these wretched creatures themselves are utterly devoid. In some states, the specimens are occasionally fed and suffered to exist for several years. But in the more temperate and better regulated regions, it is found in the long run more advantageous for the educational interests of the young to dispense with food and to renew the specimens every month, which is about the average duration of the foodless existence of the criminal class. In the cheaper schools, what is gained by the longer existence of the specimens is lost partly in the expenditure for food, and partly in the diminished accuracy of the angles, which are impaired after a few weeks of constant feeling. Nor must we forget to add, in enumerating the advantages of the more expensive system, that it tends, though slightly yet perceptibly, to the diminution of the redundant isosceles population, an object which every statesman in Flatland constantly keeps in view. On the whole, therefore, although I'm not ignorant that in many popularly elected school boards there is a reaction in favour of the cheap system, as it is called, I am myself disposed to think that this is one of the many cases in which expense is the truest economy. But I must not allow questions of school board politics to divert me from my subject. Enough has been said, I trust, to show that recognition by feeling is not so tedious or indecisive a process as might have been supposed, and it is obviously more trustworthy than recognition by hearing. Still, there remain, as has been pointed out above, the objection that this method is not without danger. For this reason, many in the middle and lower classes, and all without exception in the polygonal and circular orders, prefer a third method, the description of which shall be reserved for the next section. End of Part 1, Section 5. Recording by Ruth Golding.
So, I think actually chapter/section 6 is going to be too long and gets into some more complicated stuff. Actually, it's the explanation of some of these things because we're back into the world of figures that you would have to go to the show notes to see. I don't want to do that to you tonight. So, that was the end of our first two, the women and how we recognize people. Chapter 6, or Section 6, is called Of Recognition by Sight. And this gets more into that kind of comparison between them seeing things in the flat two-dimensional world and us actually using our two-dimensional, rather, I guess you could even say primitive vision, because it's a very old sense. In the sense of senses, and that it's not all that different. The limitations that are placed on us are very similar to the limitations that are placed on him. So that's what chapter 6 is going to get into more of. And then chapter 7, these will be in our next episode, are concerning irregular figures. And I'm looking. Chapter 6 is the one that's going to have more pictures that you will need to tune in for. So, I hope you're enjoying this. I really enjoy Abbott's whole, you know, just his kind of feel for the satire. And oh, at the end of 5, well, kind of the middle of the end of 5, did you catch that stuff that sounds an awful lot like Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal? The way that the children of the far lower classes are treated was really pretty disturbing. And one of the annotations that Stuart makes is that obviously Abbott is trying to criticize something that was going on in the educational world, but it's actually kind of hard to identify exactly what it was, although he did make note that there were some schools that if a child was going there and they were a recipient of some sort of charity, like a scholarship or, you know, some lord of the manor thought that his valet's son showed promise, so he sent him to Cambridge. I'm making stuff up. That one of the school boards suggested that that child need to wear a special color blazer with a silver medal on it to identify him as a recipient of charity. And luckily, the headmaster of that school said, no, that would be a mistake. That kid would be trounced on a regular basis. So there was, obviously, the whole idea of keeping people in their place was prominent during the Victorian era, and Abbott is making lots of comments on that. However, there is one other piece about women that I wanted to fill you in on, because I didn't know this. In the 1800s, and actually up until 1920, women were allowed to take the exams at the universities, but they wouldn't be given degrees. So, for instance, if you went and took your, you know, what would amount to the finals for a degree program, you know, if you had to go do your orals, think of it as you're doing your orals for your master's or your PhD. They would go, they would take the test. The test would be scored by the regular scholars who score everybody's test, and then they would be given their grade. But they wouldn't receive a degree. So, for example, in the British university system of that period, the student was given only one single overall grade, first, second, or third class. Five women sat the 1870 examinations, and four of them got first class marks, but their names did not appear in the class lists. That's the list of grades, because they were not permitted to be official candidates for a degree. By 1872, so that's 2 years later, one woman had passed the entire mathematical tripos, the full degree course, but still the official position was that such a performance did not merit the award of a degree if it was achieved by a woman. In 1881, 9 years later, Ms. C.A. Scott was placed level with the eighth wrangler, that's like the top eight scholars at the University at Cambridge. And in 1890, Philippa Fawcett was placed above the senior wrangler, making her the best student of the entire class, but neither were given a degree. So Abbott had some really good reasons for saying the things that he did. It wasn't until 1920 when women were finally permitted to take degrees at Cambridge, and another 50 years, that would be 1970, were elapsed before a number of individual colleges admitted students of both sexes in the UK. So, you youngins who listen to the podcast, who were born after 1970, perhaps some of the things that women were kind of irked about in the 70s make a little bit more sense when you know that that's what was going on in their lifetime. I only saw the tail end of all of this, and even the tail end that I saw was pretty horrible. It's nice to have the opportunity to make choices about what you want to do and be given credit for the things that you do achieve. We are lucky, lucky, lucky people. So, on that happy note, the happy note that we don't live in a Victorian society, I will leave you for the next couple of weeks so you can troop along and get all your shopping done and all of your knitting done. And I'm going to go finish my sister's wedding shawl. I only have, I think, two more repeats of the center section, and then I think it's 56 more rows of patterning before I can bind off. And I just hope the yarn holds out, because I really can't go buy any more right now. It's a wee bit dear, that cashmere silk it is. Oh, and don't forget Kickstarter. The Kickstarter campaign, you can click through directly to a place where you can make a pledge at the craftlit.com website. This will allow us to upgrade the code and fix some of the audio and just make your life in the Craftlit world a whole lot easier for you. And if you can't donate, please pass the information on. That is just as important. Remember, if you donate and I don't make the level of pledging that I've requested, kind of the amount of money that I'm hoping for, nobody pays. So there is no penalty, unless I do make the total and then everybody has to pay up. But that is, it's going to be interesting to see the race for the finish. Also, don't forget iPhone iTouch application available now at the iTunes application store. Yay! Wedding a-coming, knitting afoot. Life is good, and we finally had some winter weather here, so I'm kind of feeling the spirit, wearing long sleeves and slippers. I hope you are keeping warm wherever you are and enjoying yourself. And of course, for those of you who are listening in the summer of 2010, sorry about that. I hope you're keeping cool. Take care. Have a great couple of weeks, and I will talk to you very soon. Ta. Please remember to support the people who support Craftlit. Visit Knitting Out Loud, Listen While You Knit, and the Loop Knittery in New Zealand at loopknittery.co.nz. And please visit the blogs and sites of Craftlit supporters. Those links can be found in the sidebar of the show notes. The show notes can be found at craftlit.com, or you can subscribe at iTunes. Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.